Hello, I'm Alan Kohler, Editor-in-Chief of Eureka Report, finance presenter on ABC News and a columnist for The New Daily.
And you're now 70 years old, and I'm Stephen Mayne, contributor at Eureka Report, founder of Crikey, shareholder advocate and City of Manningham councillor, and we are
The Money, the Money Cafe
with the old now, man Kohler.
Now, everybody, I should tell you that Stephen and our producer Greg just presented me with a birthday cake, a little birthday cake with two candles on it. It was so nice, and they sang to me in the cafe.
Well, maybe not.
It was completely
all Greg,
tuneless.
It was all the wonderful Greg who did it, and I just got to eat the cake, and it was delicious. So thank you, Greg.
It was a very nice cake.
You are a star in so many ways.
And I did, in fact, turn 70 while I was on holidays over the past 2 weeks. So now I'm really old.
But nothing's going to change, is it? You're still going to have five jobs and
nothing's
work
change.
100 hours a week. And
I'm just enjoying myself too much,
Stephen. Satisfy multiple people on multiple platforms on multiple days every week.
I'm just having too good a time. So I feel, to be honest, I feel completely privileged to have all these people wanting stuff from me. It's good. I'll just think,
Well, I think it's a privilege to be able to have coffee with you every fortnight. So I'd actually, I'd pay for this privilege, Alan, but I get to come and talk to you and shoot the breeze for half an hour.
Well, we should talk afterwards about that.
Well, okay, all right, maybe not. Now, I brought a prop this week.
Yeah, so it's a great wad of Commonwealth Bank slips, receipts.
Yeah,
so what does this mean?
So on Sunday and Monday, I deposited close to 1,000 cheques in 18 different Commonwealth Bank branches through their
You've been keeping them in a spare room at home.
Yes, yeah, because I use them in speeches, and this is my big wad of unbanked checks. And finally, I sort of thought, look, what's the point? I can't keep collecting. I got over 1,000. It'll be funny to see how many of them bounce, because some of them are 15 years old. Now, at each ATM, they only allow 50 deposits maximum, so I had to go around at 18 different branches all over Melbourne. And so I got all this sort of $1,000 credited to the account, and then slowly over the last couple of days, I've just been getting bounced, rejected, hundreds. Babcock and Brown, $7.50 dividend, no money, your worship.
Babcock and Brown?
Yeah, it's going back that fast. So I'm just terrified. My 95-year-old dad said to me, but aren't you going to get hit with fees for lodging too many checks?
Well,
and I thought, oh, my God, I don't know. I could be bankrupted by $10,000 of fees for lodging 800 dud checks? I don't know.
Well, I doubt that it's fee-free, but, what do I know?
Well, I've never been charged for a fee, but my argument's going to be, because about 50 of them got rejected by the machine. So I'm going to say, well, you accepted these things in your scanner with the machine, so don't blame me for that. You spat out 50, all the US dollar ones and stuff, so the obvious ones. But anyway, so I've got this huge wad of deposits and a whole bunch of slips from historic taken over or failed companies, and I think I'll probably make about $100 out of it from the whole exercise.
Well, that's fascinating, Stephen.
Let's talk about some real stuff.
It's actually really boring.
It is. The election.
Now, listen, you had AGMs this morning. What happened? How many AGMs did you attend this morning?
Well, I attended three, here, there and everywhere shafted me because I couldn't log in. I think I'm suspicious of the News Corp chairman, Hamish McLennan, because I did everything right, but it just wouldn't let me into the system. But I was happy with him because they lodged the proxies with the ASX before the meeting started, which has been my big thing this season, is tell us the proxies early. Now, the old resources companies that are used to fighting and saying no to everything, like Santos and Rio Tinto and even QBE today, refuse to lodge the proxies early, but quite a few companies are doing it. So this is actually quite a good win, because then you can have a debate which is informed and say, you've had a 40% protest vote, what's going on? Whereas traditionally they hold back the bad news until after the debate. So, so Rio Tinto this morning, I had a phone call from the company secretary saying, we're only going to let you have two questions.
So they actually rang you up?
Well, I did my three-page letter making all my pre-AGM demands, do this, do that, let me ask, blah, 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 disclose the proxies early. And the company secretary rang me up and said, look, basically no to everything, except we might produce a transcript after the meeting. And by the way, we're only going to give you two questions. And I said, well, you only gave me two last year, and every other company gives me at least 10. I said, sorry, we're only going to give you two. So I lodged these two omnibus questions with about six elements in each.
I don't think you should read them out, because it's too long. Everybody, he's put the usual 15 questions into the two questions he's got. And, well, of course, they will not read them out,
well,
Stephen.
Well, in summary, it is interesting. One of them was, you know, why haven't you got more Australian-based directors after the Jerk and Gorge fiasco? And will you let the only Indigenous director, Ben Wyatt, comment on this? Now, he's got COVID, unfortunately, so he's stuck in Melbourne, couldn't go to the meeting because he's got COVID. And the second one was quoting...
But just, if I may interpose there, it was Australian-based idiot managers who were responsible for Duke and Gorge, not London-based directors.
Well, but the,
I mean, I'm not disagreeing with your proposition that there should be more Australian-based directors, but let's be clear that it wasn't. It was local people who were responsible for the catastrophe.
Well, no, I disagree. The culture, it all set from the top. And, you know, an old colonial, snooty, pommy company, the culture is, you know, make as much money as possible and don't respect the locals. And I disagree with you. I think that a fully Australian board, that wouldn't happen. I seriously believe that. But the second one was Joe Hockey said on Sky News the other week that Obama had asked him and Tony Abbott to stop sending iron ore to China in 2014. So I just asked the question, in what circumstances would you stop sending ore to China, given the Russian situation, given that the Chinese are our biggest shareholders through, they've got about 10% of Rio Tinto through one of those Chinese-controlled entities?
The answer is there are no circumstances in which Rio Tinto would stop sending iron ore to China.
But you know, I can
actually stand in for the chairman of Tinto here.
But I predict they won't even read them out because they don't want to admit. Because the good thing about online questions is they have to voice your question. So some snooty pom is not going to read out this big, long rant about... You know, Australian-based directors and banning iron ore sales to China.
I think you might be right there, Stephen.
But it's censorship and it's disappointing, and the POM should treat us colonials with a bit more respect.
Free speech.
I say. Free speech, correct. Now, let's talk about the election.
Yeah.
So today, so it's now 12:25. At 2 p.m. today, you've got the Josh versus Monique People's Forum here in the seat of Menzies. And we're obviously having a coffee in the seat of
Kooyong.
Yes.
Menzies' old seat.
Correct. Menzies' old seat. And the adjacent seat where I live is Menzies. And Josh has given her a platform. He's given her an equal time platform. It's live on Sky News. He's clearly worried. He thinks he's got to out-debate her.
I'd say he's more than worried.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think he's going to win?
I think Monique Ryan has a big chance, to be honest. I mean, I think the Josh Frydenberg panic is a clear indication of that. I think it's, you know, you can broaden it to wonder how many independents are likely to win and what does that mean for the parliament. And... I suppose I'm one of those who thinks that we're most likely to get a hung parliament.
Yeah, I agree.
Not that I'm a political expert or anything, but I do think that Zoe Daniels looking good in Goldstein, Allegra Spender in Wentworth. We've already got Zali Stegall in Warringah. She'll probably win again.
Easily.
Helen Paynes in Indi.
She'll win easily. Kate Cheney, I think, is a good chance in Julie Bishop's old seat.
And also there's obviously Andrew Wilkie in Tasmania, who will also win again. So
and North Sydney and a couple more in Sydney, which are also up for grabs. So I think we'll get at least two extras, possibly as many as four teal brandeds, which will be a good thing. And I think Josh could well go down. And I'd love to see Josh do a Campbell Newman and come and be the Victorian opposition leader from outside the parliament and then smash Daniel Andrews in the November Victorian election and become Premier of Victoria, having been thrown out of Kooyong.
Well, there you go, Josh. Josh, of course, listens to this podcast.
He does.
And he will possibly take notice of you. I think, and in fact, I think after the election, when Josh is a civilian once more, you and I should take him to breakfast.
Yeah.
At Porgy and Mr. Jones.
And give him some career advice.
Which is his local cafe, and we should take him there and give him some advice.
Yeah. I think he might become an Arnold Bloch-Liebler partner, could go on a few boards, go back to Deutsche Bank. He's got He's got many career options because he's actually a very good treasurer and would make an excellent prime minister.
But his income will triple, so I imagine his wife is barracking for Monique Warren. In fact, she will probably vote for Monique Ryan.
I think so.
And Mrs. Frydenberg.
I agree. I think Greg Hunt will be on the CSL board within a month of the election. I think that's a no-brainer because they're lacking local directors, and constitutionally they have to have a majority of Australian directors, and they're right on the margin of too many foreigners.
Right.
And he was an excellent health minister and would be an excellent CSL director. So I think that that should happen. I hope Brian McNamee makes that offer of the $300,000 a year directorship for Greg Hunt, because he's one of the few ex-polis who actually would be worth the money.
Well, I'm not sure I entirely agree with you there, Stephen, but anyway, we'll move along.
Did you watch the Treasurer's debate yesterday?
Some of it. Unfortunately, didn't manage to see all of it. Did you?
I listened to it. Yeah, I thought they were both very good. I think Chalmers and Josh are the two best performers in both sides. Both would make good leaders, prime ministers. And I really enjoyed seeing the good spirit between them, where they were saying they like each other and they get on quite well and they respect each other. And so it's unlike the toxic ScoMo-Albo relationship. They're a couple of smart blokes who actually get on despite the conflict of politics. And I think Chalmers, someone will get a promotion. Either Josh will become Prime Minister, become opposition leader if he survives, otherwise we get Dutton. And Chalmers will be a good Treasurer or opposition leader under fourth-term coalition government. But there was no mention of money printing in the debate. I mean, why didn't they say, you know, we could print $60 billion and buy a Transurban? I've been suggesting this for months with you, Alan, and it's just getting no traction.
They're just not paying any attention to you.
It's just
like all these company chairmen completely ignoring you.
Correct.
And you must feel vastly ignored, Stephen.
I do.
You probably go to the backyard and howl at the moon, do you?
Yes, exactly right. So
Now listen, tell me about Mike Cannon-Brookes and the AGL merger. Is he going to stop it?
Yes, he will. He's, as an influencing billionaire oligarch, he has, in a very controversial way, temporarily bought voting control of 11.3% through a dubious, opaque arrangement with an investment bank. He's borrowing stock and all the hedging, all this the usual rubbish. And given that 50% of the AGL retail register is owned by 150,000 retail shareholders, who only 5% will bother to vote, to get to 75% with someone sitting there with 11.3% against, the oligarch only needs, I reckon, another 3 or 4% of sympathetic institutions, and it's a dead deal. So he's got enough to block it. And I really hate the way people use these devices in corporate control transactions. It started with BHP in 2005 when they used a dodgy arrangement with Deutsche Bank to have a sneaky 4% stake in WMC Resources. And it's been used frequently since. James Packer got a sneaky 10% of Star Brambles. Outed Asciano's 1.2% stake in 2007, and that was the thing that caused people to hide, because if you buy regular shares, you can be traced like Brambles did to Asciano and then outed. So Asciano got outed with only 1.2%, whereas Kerry Stokes with Boral, he was able to emerge with a surprise 10% because he used UBS and borrowed stock. So our regulations are hopeless. The law doesn't require derivative voting control to be disclosed to the ASX. So Cannon-Brookes has driven a tractor through this loophole and come from nowhere with 11.3% when you're meant to disclose at 5%.
Yes.
Sorry, I'm ranting away there.
But you're absolutely right.
The Brits fixed this about 15 years ago. Every extra 1%, including any derivatives, has to be disclosed to the stock exchange.
Yeah.
And here, we haven't had any law reform in a decade. It's hopeless.
So what happens to AGL when their deal falls over?
Well,
the demerger.
I think the board will be up for grabs at the AGM in October, and I think Cannon-Brookes will probably come back with a control move. I mean, he clearly wants control to accelerate the closure of coal. I think he's probably inspired by Musk. He's got the dollars. This is just he doesn't need a partner like Brookfield. It's only worth $8 billion. If he can buy 29-30%, that's usually enough to control. He can stack the board and bring forward the closures. I think that's what will probably happen.
Yeah, well.
What do you reckon? Demergers never get voted down. This will be the first one.
Right. Well, your mention of Musk leads us on to the questions, because the first question is on that subject. So let's do that. Adam says, hi, Alan. Can Steve provide a follow-up on Elon Musk's Twitter deal? In Talking Finance the other week, Steve Sammartino made his views clear that Elon would not be able to afford the purchase, but it turns out he was wrong. How has Elon pulled it off?
I think it might... Was it Steve Sammartino or me? Because I think I was talking...
Oh, Steve.
I think I was talking down Musk as well. I didn't think it had happened either. But the answer is that he lined up $25 billion in debt finance from two American, two Japanese, two French and one British bank. And if you want the names, Adam, it was Andrew Earls at Morgan Stanley, Scott Tolchin at Bank of America, Jeremy Hazen at Barclays, Tim Dilworth at Mitsubishi, Ray Ventura at Mizuho, the Japanese bank, David Berker at BNP, the French bank, and Richard Knowlton at Societe Generale, the French bank. So those eight white blokes in New York were the people who signed for the $25 billion in debt finance, and then the rest he's doing on equity, because his Tesla shares are currently worth $162 billion US dollars. And he owns 17%, and he's got enough resources to put $46 billion on the table. And the board folded. They don't have a dual-class voting system like Google and Murdoch and Atlassian. So Jack Dorsey, the founder, to his credit, played it straight like Apple and Amazon and just went one vote, one value. So it's available to be purchased. And the board folded because Jack Dorsey endorsed the deal. So when the founder endorses the deal, deals can happen, and that's what's happened. But I don't know if it's going to close, because stock's trading at a 10% discount. It won't close for 6 months. So it's wrong to say Elon Musk has bought Twitter.
Yes, I thought that too.
Elon Musk has agreed to buy Twitter, but the market thinks there's a fair chance that the deal will fall over. So yes, Let's wait and see.
Yep.
So, John, love the show. Don't change the name. I have a deposit for a house sitting in my savings account earning 1.35%. But I expect finding the right place will be a bit of a process. How will cash fare with rising inflation and interest rates?
Well, the answer is interest rates are going to go up. Interest rates on deposits will go up more slowly than interest rates on loans, because the banks are clearly going to take this opportunity to pad their margins somewhat. And I think they've already started to do that. We've seen them all pass on the full extent of the RBA rate rise of 2.25%. However, savings deposit interest rates have only gone up less than that already. And look, if you just keep your eye on the comparison sites, make sure you choose the best ones. Obviously, if you're on the market for a house, you can't use a term deposit. So it's got to be a call, and you have to accept very low interest rates.
I'm just impressed that John reckons he's getting 1.35% in cash in his savings account, because the city of Manningham, where I'm a councillor, we've got 90 million of cash, and we're earning less than 1%, and we're rolling term deposits at sort of 6 to 9 months.
Yeah, so I don't know where he'd be getting 1.35%. I mean, yeah. Unless it is actually a term deposit. He might be going 6 monthly term deposits.
I mean, he could buy 10-year bonds now, and they're yielding 3.6%. So, or even Victorian bonds, which is getting close to junk in my view, given the amount of debt in Victoria. Maybe you should buy a few government bonds, because they're liquid. Although, obviously, you run the risk of capital loss. But if you want to sleep at night, keep it in the bank. But you're not going to be earning much, and you'll underperform in the long term in cash. Now, Leon has a question for Alan. Who are your favourite top 10 CEOs?
That could be a question for you as well.
Running small caps. But Alan, you've interviewed every small cap CEO in the country. So I can only critique big cap chairs.
Yeah, well, I'm very wary of naming favourites, because as soon as I do, their share price goes down dramatically. And, it's really dangerous. But look, there's a couple of them I like. I suppose. I don't know about how high up I'd put them. I really liked the CEO. I love Dickie Deek of
Dickadata.
No, Deckmill in Perth.
Oh,
I mean, mainly because of his name. I mean, he's stuck with his name's Richard, right? Deke is his surname, D-I-Q-U-E, and he's gone with Dickie.
Dickie Dick. Aren't their shares like 5 cents? They almost went broke, Deck Mill, but it wasn't his fault. He's the cleanup guy.
He's the cleanup guy, and yeah, he's doing a good job. I mean, I mean, bearing in mind that I don't actually know anything more about these people than I get in half an hour of an interview, right? Yeah. So this bloke's on the end of a line from Perth. But I like the way he talks. Yeah. He was frank.
Did he give an honest answer as to how a mining contractor goes, a Perth-based mining contractor goes broke in a boom?
Yes, well, he did, in fact, and it was building prisons in New Zealand.
Right, okay.
And so, as I pointed out to him, New Zealand's a long way from Perth.
Yes.
And, you know, and prisons are not mines.
Well, Jack Bendat, he owns the Perth Wildcats. He was Kerry Stokes' business partner for 20 years. He lives in Perth. He's in his 90s now. He used to have a rule that he would never put a dollar of his money if he couldn't get to it within 90 minutes. So he had a 90-minute rule.
Right.
So he would go to wineries in the Margaret River, but no further.
That's funny.
So that's why he and Stokes did not outbid Frank Lowy for Channel 10 because
funny.
It broke his 90-minute rule around WA.
So I really like Lindsay Partridge of Brickworks, but we don't.
Climate. He's a great straight talker. I did listen to your interview with him the other week. He's a terrific straight talker.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. But it's not a small cap. I really like Justin Werner of Nickel Mines. Justin's got it worked out. He's living in Bali. And he's got his family there. They've presumably got a lovely resort-style villa in Bali. And his business is in, the island? The island to the north of Bari, Suriname or something like that. Anyway, so their operations are in Indonesia. It's an Australian company. He's living in Bali. He's got a lovely life. So he's got it worked out. He was good. Who else do I like? Oh, yeah, I really liked the bloke at K2 Fly. You've ever heard of K2 Fly?
Is that Campbell?
No, the CEO's name is Nick. The CEO's name is Nick Pollock, and K2 Fly, that's K2FLY. What they do is that they provide software platforms for mining companies to monitor their ESG performance. And they're building up a portfolio of big clients, including Rio Tinto. So Rio Tinto is now a client of K2 Fly to try to keep on top of their ESG after Juukan and Gorge. BHP, Anglo American, all these big companies are now using this, and their shares have gone up since I interviewed them, which is terrific.
His just hope they Nick don't Pollock. Get exploited by these massive companies.
So I like him, and I actually, after the interview, went and bought some shares.
Alan, you haven't had a good record at doing that, have you?
No, a shocker.
You should be an index investor, mate. You fall in love with people.
No, I should.
You
what I should do?
People you know, and you shouldn't do that.
I should just. What I should do is just talk about companies and not invest.
Not invest in them. I agree. So, well, my favourites. I like Andrew Hansen at Hansen Technology because he's the only CEO who has a headquarter in the city of Manningham. And favourite shares, I quite like Hamish McLennan at REA, even though he somehow locked me out of the HT&E AGM this morning. And Gonski's Captain Smooth, he's probably the best chair. Other people I like are small caps who turn companies into big caps. The Bassett brothers at Seek, Greg Roebuck at Car Sales, Twiggy at Fortescue, Peter Wilson and his dad Alan Wilson at Reece, and the best of all, Brian McNamee. When he started out in 94, I think you can argue that CSL was a small cap at $300 million, small cap in today's terms. Now,
yes.
Now capped at $131 billion, and he's still the chair, about to appoint Greg Hunt to the board. So, he's my favourite. Once was a small cap CEO.
That's fair enough. US GDP fell 1.4% last quarter. This is from Ben, this question. If they have another falling quarter, they are in recession. US interest rates are 0.25% with inflation rampant. What do Feds do if they have inflation and recession at the same time? Well, of course, interest rates in the US are now 50 basis points higher than that, 0.75 to 1%, and will be rapidly increased from here on. The US will not be in recession because the June quarter will be positive, I think.
Yep, correct.
Yes, if they have inflation and recession at the same time, that's called stagflation.
Yep.
That'll be really bad.
They should increase rates modestly, but most important in my mind, they should stop printing money. That's the other way you can sort of try and deal with inflation is money supply.
Yes.
So, and then obviously part of the inflation is supply chain, COVID, Russian war stuff, and interest rates have got nothing to do with any of that.
Yep.
Dan, can you please explain how raising interest rates will slow rising inflation when inflation this time around is caused by, as I just mentioned, global supply chain issues and more recently labour cost pressure due to labour market shortages? Won't raising rates just add more costs and pressure into the system and therefore snowball inflation further?
Well, yes, but that's the idea with raising interest rates. It raises costs and the idea is that it suppresses demand because everyone's basically can't afford anything and they have to pull their horns in, and so that's the proposal.
And the most important thing we need to suppress is...
The thing to bear in mind, Dan, is that interest rates are the only tool that anyone has for controlling inflation. Nobody else has the job of controlling inflation except the Reserve Bank, and the only tool they've got is interest rates. And so even if inflation is caused by supply chain issues or whatever, the only thing they can do is whack the economy over the head with interest rates to hope that people stop buying the stuff.
That's right. And I think from my point of view, the asset price inflation in housing is the most important thing that needs to be curtailed by stopping printing money and zero interest rates. At some levels, this is why I'm a Republican in Zimbabwe, but because everyone is printing money, no one seems to worry, and no one even mentioned printing money in the Treasurer's debate yesterday, when that, for my mind, that has been an inflationary element in all of this.
Christopher says, conventional wisdom has long been that a HECS debt is perhaps the best type of debt, as there is no interest, but it's indexed to CPI, and therefore it's the last thing you should pay off. With an inflation rate over 5%, returns on deposits about 1%, and taxable and wages growth stagnant, it occurs to me that the conventional calculus should change. It looks pretty expensive in the current environment. I'm surprised this has not received more attention. Would you care to comment? Stephen.
Well, I think that it's an obvious. I mean, given how much money that Morrison is throwing around, if they want to try and get a few student votes, and Greg was telling me earlier that TikTok videos in Kooyong are popping up of a topless Josh Frydenberg appealing to the student vote. So if you want to appeal to the student vote...
I don't think that would appeal to students, would it?
Well, Greg thought it was
topless,
quite ineffective
and
so that he was desperate. But, they should cap this. They should stop indexation, just like they've halved petrol index, because it's unfair to suddenly start indexing the HELP debt, Higher Education Loan Program, which is currently $68.7 billion. If that's going to start going up 5% a year, then yes, it's a rip-off, and you should pay it off as soon as you can, because it's certainly rising faster than interest if you've got money in the bank. And so pay off your credit card debt first, your 20%, your margin loan on your shares at 8% next, and then pay off your HECS debt. But yeah, I think that it's surprising that there hasn't been a bigger furor about this sudden surge of indexation of this debt, because last year I think it was $4.3 billion got repaid, but $6.3 billion got accrued of new debt by all those students out there. So it's a very sensitive issue for a lot of indebted Australians.
So how much HECS debt is this?
68.7
billion.
Yeah.
So that's what they could. They could print the money and forgive all the HECS debt.
Yeah, and then print more and buy
instead of buying Transurban. No.
Yeah. But Josh printed $280 billion, so we can do it all, Alan, in the next term if we do another $280
billion. No, but if that would guarantee them re-election, wouldn't it? If they said after the election, if you re-elect us, we'll forgive all HECS debt.
Yeah.
How about that?
Anyone who said that would win. That should be the sort of, because early voting starts on Monday morning at 9 o'clock, right? So it goes for 2 weeks. So the last chance you've got to reach every voter is the big announcement on Sunday, and the TV ratings on Sunday night are always the highest. So ScoMo and Albo, get out there on Sunday morning, go on Insiders, announce this policy of forgiving all HECS debt by printing money, and you'll win the election.
There you go. Ewan says, I enjoy the podcast. Oh, no, you're going to read this one. I read the last one. Your turn.
Yes. Ewan enjoys the podcast, looks forward to it every week, and he wants us to keep telling him what we really think. And he's always been intrigued by the concept of the economic clock. Do you think it has merit? If so, what time is it? 5 past the boom? And by the way, he was telling a doctor friend about how much cannabis Terry White in Hawthorne was selling, and said he had they've set themselves up as a wholesaler distributor. So that would be an outlier. And don't be fooled by the sample size of your survey, Alan. So you can have a start there, Alan. Terry White, chemist in Hawthorne, is he a wholesaler?
Well, I saw that and I didn't ask him. I should have asked a follow-up question. Are you a wholesaler? And I didn't.
Because so what percentage of his sales? 40% or something, was it?
Something like that, yeah.
My only connection with Terry White was the only time I've ever been invited to give a speech and offered money to attend an event and told you don't have to speak, you just got to sit there, was Terry White, $1,500 to sit at some dinner. And this was when Woolworths was trying to get into pharmacy. And I said, no, I'm not going to. This is cash for access. This is influence. I can't take money to just hear.
You're so pure.
Oh, so pure. Oh, that's why I'm
that.
So poor.
Oh, I love that.
Pure and poor.
Pure and poor.
But
anyway, the investment clock. If you Google investment clock, economic clock, you'll come up with a circular clock that has slowdown in the kind of 12 to 3 o'clock section in the right top right quadrant, then recession. In the bottom right quadrant, the bottom left quadrant has recovery, and then boom in the top left quadrant. So it goes recovery, so it goes recovery, boom, slow down, recession, recovery, boom, slow down, recession. And that's the proposition.
What time is it now? I think he's probably right. It's about 12:05. Interest rates start to go up at the top of the boom.
Precisely. So, look, it generally is a reasonable guide to the cycle because the economy does work in a cycle. The cycle, a lot of people thought the cycle had been abolished by quantitative easing and central banks cutting interest rates to virtually zero.
That's the down cycle abolished. And they've just instead created an up cycle by trying to stop
that's
the down
right.
cycle.
So the idea was that, you know, that they were not going to actually crunch the economy into recession this time.
Keating style.
But here we are. That looks like likely to happen. So,
yeah, I agree. Now, Greg says, just rediscovered your Money Cafe. I've missed the old cafe episode. Funny how they did not mention it. You had a new podcast. My comment, typical News Corp, not to mention the competition like that. Greg's first ever question. How does Australian sharebroker HelloStake.com, who are CHESS sponsored, make money on $3 brokerage on Aussie shares? Are they mucking about with buy-sell prices? Should I recommend HelloStake to my kids or tell them to join CommSec?
So Stake is an online broker based in Sydney that started off broking American shares to Australian clients, and the brokerage is zero for American shares. It's $3 for ASX shares. And where they make their money is on the foreign exchange.
Oh, right.
So they,
okay.
So they make a spread, a clip. Whenever anyone changes their money from Australian dollars into US dollars, they do it and they get the spread on that. And they also make interest on the float, the money.
Yeah, the money you've got left over for your shares.
The money you've got left over.
And what about are they doing what Robin Hood does and selling the buy flow? Buy-sell data to institutions?
I don't think so.
No, okay.
I think not. And I think that the proposition for the Australian shares, because $3 is the cheapest brokerage for ASX share brokerage in Australia, is $3. But what they're trying to do, I think, is to build up a clientele who they'll then upsell into American shares.
Correct.
And get the foreign exchange.
Yeah. Or just build up a big client list with a free offer. It's a bit like, selling subscriptions. Give it to them free to start with and charge them later.
In general, it is fair to say that brokerage is becoming a feature rather than a thing in itself.
Yes. Well, I've been with CommSec longer than I've been married because I joined them in the late 1990s and I'm still copping the $10 a pop every time still copping no interest on the cash float. But I find it very easy and the systems are good and you get the odd float you can buy into. So,
final question from James. I often hear that education is our third largest export, yet when COVID kicked off, we were immediately presented to lines of international students at food banks as they were no longer able to work. And the government recently lifted the cap on working hours for international students. I'm starting to suspect that education isn't really as big an export earner as advertised, and a lot of the money paid in fees, rents, etc. is generated locally. Thoughts?
Well, the first thing I'd say is I think the biggest single mistake that ScoMo made with the pandemic was telling all the foreign students to go home. I mean, it was one, it was uncaring, and two, it was ridiculous because it is a, they are a massive export owner. He treated them as a as like they were refugees on a boat or something. And then we have these massive labour shortages because we basically told all the foreign students to disappear, wouldn't give any JobKeeper to the universities, let alone the students. And so they all went home and suddenly had a record low unemployment and labour shortages. So it's a massive industry. I remember being a City of Melbourne councillor and the boss of Melbourne Uni came in and said, do you realise that we are your biggest export earner? Because we are receiving $300 million a year just for the 11,000 foreign students on our Parkville campus alone. That is the most of any campus in the world. And Melbourne is in the top four cities in the world for foreign students, alongside Paris, New York and London. And I thought, and then I asked our officers about this and they said, yes, 42% of residents in the City of Melbourne are students. So vibrant.
42%.
42%. RMIT and Melbourne Uni are massive institutions for the vibrancy of the wonderful 24-hour city that is Melbourne. So it's absolutely pivotal. We get the brightest from Asia mainly coming here. They then bring their capital back later on. They provide workers in McDonald's.
Well, and Glenfrey Road, Hawthorne, which is my patch, has become also a wonderful cosmopolitan strip
full of
because
students.
Of Swinburne.
And that's probably why Josh is going to lose.
Because
the Liberals lost the state seat of Hawthorne because of all the students in the Hawthorne-Swinburne campus.
Really?
So, yeah, that's why it's not snotty Toorak around here. It's far more a student electorate because of Swinburne.
Yeah.
So, and is it? Hey, can you make money out of it? Well, I look at IDP education. They floated at $2.65 in November 2015. The stock's now $27 with a market cap of $7.5 billion. And Andrew Bassett, the CEO of SEEK, said last year it was one of his three biggest regrets, selling out so cheaply. And there's still a whole bunch of universities that own 20%, and that stake alone is worth $1.5 billion. So we make it out of public companies, we make it from the economy, it's good for labour. Bring on Australia as a global powerhouse for international students.
Well said, Stephen. Thanks, everyone, for listening to today's episode of The Money Cafe. James Thompson will be back next week in the cafe. I'm delighted to be back from 2 weeks' leave. Thanks to everybody for filling in for me while I was away. If you've got a question, send it in to themoneycafe@eurekareport.com.au. Until next week, I'm Alan Kohler, Editor-in-Chief of Eureka Report.
I'm Stephen Mayne, Councillor at City of Manningham, shareholder advocate and Eureka Report contributor, and we have been
The Money
Cafe. Money Cafe.